Well, hello everyone. It is such an honor to be here with all of you to discuss the topic of citizen science. I have to be honest, when I was assigned this panel, I didn't know too much about citizen science, but then I started thinking about it, that it basically asks everybody to be their most curious selves. I think that curiosity is a very innate human trait. For myself, definitely, it's probably one of my most defining human traits. And citizen science just gives people an opportunity to actually use that curiosity in a way that can be useful to collect data and be used by wonderful panelists like both of Ashley and Greg here. So just to give a brief primer, citizen science has been used in so many different types of applications, many of which we'll explore today. For example, it's been used there's been adventurers, mountaineers who've gone and collected scat samples and brought them back to a lab, and that they've been able to isolate different types of genes as a result. People in very rural areas can take pictures of chickens, kind of start detecting if avian flu is about to have an outbreak somewhere. So there's a lot of different ways that we can use it. So I'm really excited to talk about how we can advance that field and give it as much recognition and support that we can. I'm so honored to be here with two highly accomplished people. First, we have Ashley Earle. She is the head of bacterial genomics. She's a microbiologist and genomic scientist at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. And over here we have Greg Trinish, who is the executive director of Adventure Scientists. He's also a National Geographic explorer and a Draper Richards Kaplan entrepreneur. So two highly credible voices to learn about this field. So I was hoping that we could just start with both of you introducing a little bit more of yourselves, a little bit more about the work you do, and maybe talk about what brought you into citizen science in the first place. Like, why did this field attract you? So Ashley, do you want to start?
I'd be happy to. So First and foremost, since this is on record, I just want to say this is the first. Am I on? There I am. This is the first time I've been to the Aspen's Idea Festival, and I have to say it has blown my mind. This has been amazing. So I want to thank all of the organizers, and Sarah Guy, thank you for organizing us to come and speak to everybody here. So I am Ashley Earle, and I when I was thinking about what it was about me that you should know, two things came to mind. One, of course, is yes, I'm a scientist who's recently ventured into citizen science with this wonderful partner here. I have the great fortune to work at an institute that sits smack dab in the middle of MIT's campus, and partly, I'm sure, because of that, we've really become, I think, one of the innovation hubs, technology hubs, around applying technologies to answer questions around human health. And so, as Sarah mentioned, I'm a microbiologist. I love bacteria. And so the kinds of work that we do are focused on bacteria and human health. And I think, technology aside, I'm a very lucky person because what I do every day is work with some of the leading experts in the field, like Michael Gilmore, who's a partner with me and with Greg, who try to tackle some of the most pressing questions related to microbes and human health. And I'm also excited that more recently we've been partnering with people like Greg. Greg, who has been, you'll hear lots more from Greg about Greg. He's amazing. I always used to say, I mean, honestly, I would say, I have the coolest job ever. And then I met Greg and I was like, well, it's among the coolest jobs. But the bottom line is Greg galvanizes other citizens to really come in and I would argue, bring to the table mission critical information and specimens that allow us to tackle these questions. And the questions that have been keeping us up at night are around antibiotic resistance. And so just a show of hands, who was here for the last session? Yeah, so I was super excited to hear about the focus on antibacterial resistance. I expect we're gonna be talking more about that. And I guess one other show of hands, I'm just curious who in this room has been, either had an antibiotic resistant infection or has known someone with a resistant infection? Okay, so thankfully the numbers are small, but all the projections say they're gonna go up. And so anyway, we'll talk more about that in a moment. So the other just quick thing I wanted to tell you, because I think it is important, is I'm a new mom. And so when I was, thank you. Thank you very much. It's awesome. It really is. But I think also what it has done is completely shifted the way I think about just about everything, but certainly my role as a scientist and my responsibilities to society. And I think I'm probably not alone in recognizing that we're at a time when science and facts and maybe truth are under attack in a way that maybe, at least in my lifetime, I haven't seen before. And so given that, I think when I think about what that does in terms of defining the future that I'm going to experience and the future that my son is going to experience and his children, I realize that, you know, engaging the greater public in science and the scientific thought in that, you know, you can sort of come to facts and truth is super important, and especially when we're dealing with challenging questions like climate change and antibiotic resistance. So that's me.
Wow, thank you so much, Ashley. And I totally agree that, you know, just like the act of bringing people into a scientific process, you know, there's so much psychology around if you're involved with something that you believe it more, you trust it, you start to feel, you, and also you realize why it's important. So I think that's such a huge service that citizen science can offer the world. So Greg, I'd love to hear from you. What brought you into citizen science? And maybe also talk a little bit more about what you do.
Yeah, so I'm the founder and executive director of Adventure Scientists. So we're a nonprofit organization based in Bozeman, Montana. And our job is to provide partners like Ashley with data collected from the outdoors where they can really be used to drive forward decision-making and solutions to really challenging problems. So the greatest part about my job is not that I get to go adventure in the outdoors. That happened for a lot of my life, and I started as an adventurer, but it's much more that I get to learn from people like Ashley and Mike Gilmore and our partners at the World Resources Institute about these incredible issues and be at the front lines of a lot of these issues. And I mentioned I started as an adventurer, and that is how I kind of came to citizen science. Was I was out exploring the world and literally walking the length of continents, and realized that I just didn't like being out there without purpose and without mission. And I had many times throughout those journeys when I wanted to quit and felt like quitting, but the one consistent thing that drove me to that was that selfish feeling. And I never did quit, but I rather found the sciences, and I started working as a wildlife biologist tracking lynx and wolverines and grizzly bears up in Montana, tracking owls in California, working with sturgeon and the Missouri River. And through these experiences, I realized that I was making a difference. I was doing something I loved to do and being outside. And I got to go walk around the woods at night and hoot for owls. Like, that's the coolest thing ever. But I started combining that with biological expeditions. And so I'd partner with nonprofits, with scientists who needed data. And we would develop a protocol. And then I'd go on these long treks from eastern side of Yellowstone to the western side of the Frank Church in Idaho. Was one of the first ones I did that was truly a biological expedition. And what I realized was that I could teach a lot of people to do this if I just learned exactly what the missions were we needed to send people on. We could develop protocols and get an army of people out there collecting data. And so I started it 7 years ago, and we've run over 130 projects at this point and sent tens of thousands of volunteers all over the world doing everything from collecting the highest known plant life on Earth from Mount Everest, which is now being used to double crop yields in India through fungal symbiotic relationships that we found up on Mount Everest, to getting to work on antibiotic resistance with researchers from Harvard and MIT. And for me, it's all about that end goal and that purpose. And I think the engagement of the volunteer and this ability to really get people involved in these issues. I mean, this is Locke, John Locke, right? This is life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, and we earn property through labor. We own these issues when we work on these issues. I think that it's really important that citizen science moves more away from education and being focused on education and focused on outcomes, because if the outcomes are real, the education will follow, the engagement will follow. Otherwise, it becomes a novel thing that wears off after you go out and collect data once or twice. If it doesn't matter, if it doesn't do anything, if it doesn't change the world, then I think we lose a real opportunity to keep people engaged.
Wow, thank you so much. So Greg, I just want to ask a little bit more about these environments where people are collecting data from, whether it's from Mount Everest or from Greenland or from Montana or all over the world that you send these volunteers or these volunteers mm-hmm. go. So how exactly does the data collection happen? How do you get it from something from a mountaintop to a place like the Broad Institute?
Yeah, so with each project we take on, we think of these as investments, and we have this incredible network that we can invest. And we spend a lot of time with our partners developing protocols, figuring out what are the actual things that are needed, whether it's the metadata that we're collecting alongside a scat sample or an insect sample. And so we put together, based on that mission, based on exactly what we need from where, a profile of who's the volunteer we need to go and get it. And then we'll recruit to our network. We have about 8,000 people a month coming to our website asking how they can get involved. And when we have the right mission for them, we'll deploy them, we'll train them. Everyone goes through a pretty intensive training. It can be online. A lot of times we'll supplement with field trainings depending on the needs of the partner. And then they go on these expeditions trained and having passed tests and gotten permitted and all these things, which takes a lot of time and effort. And then they'll pick up an insect in the middle of the Amazon jungle. And most often we're mailing them back to the Broad Institute or to our other partners. And that's where the real science happens.
That's amazing. And it's also nice to know that the volunteers fit into missions that you decide. So it feels like in order for it to get more outcomes based, you know, instead of, you don't want just, I'm sure Ashley, you wouldn't want to open up your mailbox and just like see a scat sample in there. Never mind.
We were at dinner last night and Mike and Ashley, like there was a moth and Mike was like, yes, I got one.
And I was like, yeah. Scat, okay. Moths, not so much.
So then it comes over to places like the Broad Institute. So how do you then take that data? I know that you're able to analyze it and put it into your work. How does that work?
So I think, you know, sort of backing up to kind of the mission that we've been on together, you know, for those of you who were in the last session, we heard about the arms race between humans and microbes, and that's been going on for a while, for about 80, 90 years, since we, you know, took antibiotics that are natural products made by microbes to interact with each other and sometimes to fight, sometimes to talk, and use them against the microbes, right? And as soon as we started to do that, they started to resist it and do bad things to us. And so we've been going back and forth for decades. And while there's no doubt about it, antibiotics have been fundamental to shaping our society, to, you know, prolonging our lives, saving countless lives. The balance is sort of tipping right now, right? So we're starting to see that the microbes are starting to win, and the projections are really scary. So I think one of the most scary ones is that by 2050, a time when I plan on still being around, there will be 10 million deaths each year from resistant infections. That's 2 million more deaths each year than the number of people who die from cancer today. That's a lot of problems. And so, you know, why is that? And that's certainly something that's happening with a particular group of organisms that we've been studying intensely called the enterococci. And the enterococci are really cool. So it turns out that they are leading causes of hospital infection in the United States, but also worldwide. But none of us are strangers to them. In fact, we're all vessels containing enterococci. So we all have them. And it turns out we've recently surmised that the enterococci sort of came into existence about 450 million years ago. In fact, we think that they sort of came on land. Their ancestors probably lived in some of these permafrost kind of environments we heard about in the last session. in water, you know, aquatic environments. But as, you know, organisms crawled onto land and start to, you know, live on dry surfaces, we think that's what sort of led to the emergence of enterococci. And it's fabulous. And now we know, and partly based on the work that Greg and his group have done, that these bugs live in just about every single terrestrial organism out there, from a worm to an insect to a reptile to a bird to mammals to us. And they've done so seemingly happily, and happily for us, for eons, and yet something's happened, right? Something's shifted in the last 50, 60, 70 years. And what is that? And that's what we're really after. What's caused this change, and how can we learn about it and try to do something about it? And so, I think it's clear we're going to need new antibiotics, and that's something we talk a lot about, how we can work together to come up with new targets. But I think where the field is going is figuring out how to sort of de-escalate this arms race that we have, fundamentally new ways of dealing with the problem, and that's part of what we're doing. So why citizens?
I'd love to hear about, like, so then how did these data samples that you get from people like Greg's volunteers, how did they play in, and how, what's the difference that you've seen between those types of data samples versus ones that you get in more traditional clinical settings?
It's a great question, and I think I give Mike Gilmore a lot of credit, because I think it was really work in his group about 10 years ago, maybe a little longer, where I think started to shift the focus away from the clinic. So up until just recently, all of our work was focused, okay, we've got a problem, it's in the hospital, it's causing people to be sick, so let's study that problem and figure out what it is and how it works, and then we'll come up with solutions. The problem is, doing it that way, it's like understanding darkness without knowing what light is, right? Mm-hmm. We need to understand the context. And so I think what we're now learning by going out into the world and say, okay, yes, we need to see what's going on in the hospitals, but we need to understand the wider context. What are these organisms like outside of these environments? And that gives us the contrast to start to see what's different, what's the same, what does that tell us about what, you know, what was that flip that switched, you know, along the way to cause these things to start to harm humans, and how have they evolved since? So I think that's one of the ways that citizen science has helped, and I think importantly the way that Greg's group in particular are just really important is that we live in an antibiotic saturated world, right? In the United States, there are as much as about 8 million pounds of antibiotics that are used clinically each year, 30 million pounds in agriculture. So that's just in the United States. Once you go outside of our borders, it's the view can be even bleaker than that. And so there's hardly a place in this earth that hasn't been sort of saturated with these human-produced antibiotics. And so that's a problem, right? Because then, you know, if we want to get the maximum contrast, we need to go and see what did Enterococcus look like 400 million years ago. Mm-hmm. And the only way we're going to get there is if we go into environments that have not been touched by human-produced and distributed antibiotics. And that's where I think Greg's team in particular just really shines and gives us that content. So I don't know if you want to talk about, like, the places you guys go and the kind of stuff you've collected. It's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, we've been all seven continents multiple times. I mean, we've collected the largest data set on Earth for microplastics, and that was ocean rowers. We've had people climbing Mount Everest, as you heard about. We, for this project in particular, we've done one round of surveying around the globe, and we collected from 110 countries, including everything from Arctic fox in Greenland to we've gotten worms in the middle of Uganda, and the list goes on and on.
Places where I think, you know, we could argue that are more pristine and have not been as sort of, you know, humanized. Yeah. And so, and what we've now learned through these collections is that we've learned a ton, you know, and it's completely transformed our view of the enterococci. We now appreciate that there's, you know, I think at least 40% more diversity within the group than we appreciated before. We're honing in on, you know, there's a many thousands of genes if you tally up all the genes that are encoded in the genomes of many all of these organisms. But through the comparisons of them, we can start to hone in on just a few that we think are probably the key ones that have enabled us to sort of, or enabled them to cause issues. And so it really has been transformative.
These guys are amazing. They've narrowed the search down to 126 genes potentially responsible.
I think it's getting narrower.
Yeah.
Work is ongoing.
Goodness. Yeah, so you see, I mean, this is not amateurish stuff
at all. No,
you know, this
cool.
is highly advanced science. So I'm just wondering, actually, just getting back to the concept of citizen science, since you both work in it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this panel is titled Advancing Citizen Science. And I think to do that, it's first good to just get a clear sense of what its reputation is today, mm-hmm. and how do people perceive it, and what do you think can be done to continue to bring it more into the mainstream scientific community?
Yeah, I think I'll ask you guys, like, who has thought of citizen science as amateur science here, or at least heard others thinking of it that way? So I would be completely wrong in my assumption then. I think that's the thought it gets. And when people first hear about amateurs out in the field collecting data, that's the first thought that enters most people's head is, oh, that can't be real science, or that can't be doing anything that's leading to discoveries. I think there's so many examples of actual projects that have made incredible discoveries and that are making real differences. And again, citizen science is not just going out in the field and collecting data. There's people looking to the stars and discovering new galaxies. There's people that are wearing Fitbits and learning all kinds of things about human health and human movement. And that's all citizen science too. So I think that it's just a matter of having the right interfaces and having the right training for volunteers, yes, but the right technology and the right types of projects that are gonna suit volunteers in the field. We shouldn't expect that volunteers are going to go out in the field and then be entitled to run the Broad Institute antibiotics lab or biota lab. And that's not what I think citizen science can achieve and should be thought of as. But those end goals are still so essential and so important. I'll just go back to what I started with. It's just if we're asking people to go collect data on birds or planets or whatever else it is, and they don't get that feedback loop, if you guys go out and collect butterflies for a pollinator project, but you don't understand why that matters or who's using those data to make a real difference, and you believe in that difference, you're going to do it once or twice and kind of lose interest. And so that's what I really hope is clear, is that there are opportunities with the millions and millions of people who want to be citizen scientists to really direct that energy and harness that energy to solve some of the biggest challenges we face.
Excellent.
Excuse me, but you know so much more about this than I certainly do, or maybe others. What issues? I mean, you're talking about issues, and I don't know what you mean.
In terms of the antibiotic
why
resistance.
Why are you collecting that data, and what outcomes are you running the data against? I'm sort of lost.
No, thank you for asking. I don't think we got into the details, so I'm happy to. So the approaches that we've been taking to understand how it is that these bacteria that live in you and in me are now causing problems in the hospital is we're taking a comparative approach. And what we're comparing is the genetics of these organisms. So we're taking an organism into the lab and we're solving its genome. So we're sequencing all the A's, T's, C's, and G's that make up its genetic material.
Go back three steps.
Yeah.
What issues?
So I think the primary issue is that these have now become leading causes of hospital-acquired infection. You go into the hospital for something that has nothing related to infection, and then you're in there, and then all of a sudden you become very ill because you've likely acquired a resistant organism that's hanging out in that hospital environment. This happens a lot. It's another word for it is nosocomial infections. And this is a big problem. It causes people a lot of heartache and death. And so we need to figure out why. Why is it that these organisms are able to persist in these environments and come into contact with you, a patient that before you walked in had no problem, right? and now you've gotten that problem. And unfortunately, these organisms that we're most concerned about, once they infect you, they're also resistant to the therapies that we would normally use to treat that infection, and they don't work. So that means you are likely to not do well. And so that's the issue, is that this is a problem that's in hospitals, it's killing people, and the problem and it's growing. So the issue is growing. We don't seem to have a good handle on how to control it. And in the absence of new therapies.
So if you don't mind.
Isn't there a toxic solution that often is applied in hospitals on walls and everything else? And
yeah.
Then can be diluted so that it actually washes a patient when they come out of the IU?
That's an excellent question. And the answer is yes, of course. There's a lot of effort that goes into disinfecting the environment and disinfecting individuals. The tricky thing is, and we're trying to figure this out, these organisms have figured out a way to resist those efforts. They survive them. Everything else perished, but these survive them. So how do they do it? And once we can figure out how, maybe we can figure out a better way to deal with the issue. They're tricky. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a big problem.
So if we can get back to just talking more about just like the overall idea of citizen science. It's really, really interesting to hear, you know, like what you think the overall reputation is and how making sure the people who are going out and participating are well trained to do so. It also just made me think of like what are the, on the flip side, what the risks are to relying on citizen science. When I was thinking about this a couple of weeks ago, I remembered how the bombing that happened a few years ago during the Boston Marathon, that there were people who, there were some security cameras and the footage got out, and there were people on Reddit who were playing like citizen policemen or citizen investigators, and I trying to ID who the person was who had perpetrated the crime. And people ended up actually finding the wrong person. So I'm just curious to know, how do you keep risks like this at bay, or how do you keep people from sensationalizing, you know, oh my gosh, there's this huge disease outbreak when actually it's not that serious?
Yeah, so again, I think this comes back to study design. It's and if you're going out and collecting data for data's sake, or you're trying to work on. I mean, I keep coming back to birds because birds is one of the biggest citizen science projects that's ever happened. But if you don't know exactly what the scientific questions you are asking are, then you're not going to answer those questions.
Right.
And so I think any scientist in the room would understand that you have to identify your questions, mm-hmm. and then you go about answering them. And so you design your study to answer those. And I think citizen science has to be held to that exact same standard. I don't think that it's right to give people this educational experience without having real genuine questions that you want them to answer and want them to help be part of. And so it all goes back to that study design. Had there been a systematic approach that the FBI was asking for people's help with, that they were going to go out and use the best and latest and greatest technologies to figure out if that was the right person or not from the Boston Marathon bombing, I think that there would have been much more success.
So I think that's right. I think that's right on. The other thing that comes to my mind is actually, in some ways, I'm less concerned about citizens who are engaging in the scientific process as I am concerned about scientists who, you know, under whatever pressures there may be, and there are a lot of pressures, who might be, you know, overinflating the kinds of things that they're doing. And I would also say I have concerns about media who, you know, because they're interested, obviously, in getting people's attention, right, that they also sort of set an unrealistic expectation for. So anyway, it's just to say that I think in some ways, I think it's the scientists and perhaps the press that I'm most worried about.
That's great. So I would love at this time to open it up to the audience. It's a couple of hands already. So I think there's someone with a microphone coming around. So
Hi, thanks. Oh, yeah. So as you're talking, I'm coming, it's a wonderful introduction to a subject I know very little about. I think in my context, inside healthcare and inside data analytics, we're trying to understand a lot more about the efficacy versus effectiveness bridge and how to understand what's happening in the real world and how to get data back to providers a long time after they've intervened. And so there's a lot of people coming up with technical solutions for that, but what we really haven't solved for is patient engagement. And we've seen in the traditional public health sphere response rates to surveys plummeting as attention is drifting elsewhere and as trust has gone down. And I'm wondering whether one of the solutions to that might be a shift from a culture of study subject to a culture of citizen scientist and the empowerment and engagement that brings. And so I'm wondering whether, as you sort of think creatively, if there are any lessons learned that we could take from the kind of hands-on outdoor tactic citizen scientist experiences you've had and leverage in the healthcare area to get people engaged in their own data.
That's a great question.
Yeah, a ton of them, I think. I mean, starting with, again, those outcomes that I keep coming back to, and if it's somebody's personal health, that's obviously going to motivate them in a way that many other things wouldn't. I think it's that feedback loop, making sure that you build in from the beginning that clear stream of data going back to the volunteer, back to the participant, so that they know exactly how they contributed, why it was important. That is something we've learned has been essential. Really solid trainings and making sure that people are taking the time to understand exactly what's required of them, that it's really important that you follow a protocol. You know, with our earliest projects, we would totally see that people would go out and collect data and we'd get data forms back and there'd be three fields that weren't filled in. And so we throw out that entire piece of data or that entire set of data. And so that, you know, we learned to iterate over the years of how to make sure people really get how important it is to follow a protocol and having a protocol to follow in the first place, giving it to them in video and in written format and in verbal format so they actually interact with our staff. Every volunteer has what we call our volunteer coordinator working with them, answering questions for them. It's a customer service line for our volunteers. I think that's something that has increased our data quality exponentially.
And I would just add, I think going forward, I feel like my sense is that there needs to be sort of a cultural shift in this. And I can, you know, where my mind goes is, you know, at the earliest stages of growth and education, that we start to empower society to be a citizen scientist at the very start. Like, you are going to be an owner of the knowledge base about yourself and your world, and start that young, and so that it sort of persists through life. And so then it's not a no-brainer that someone who's in the hospital, you know, you would think these would be some of the most willing participants out there, but it's shocking to hear that there's a drop-off. So I wonder if it needs to start early.
Mm-hmm. The question I have is that how much have we explored the ocean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I've heard that there's, from Scripps Clinic and Scripps, research, that there's a lot that we can really benefit from going into the ocean.
Yeah, I've heard estimates that it's less than 5% is kind of the one that I most consistently hear. I think that's probably an overestimate. When you look at a woman from Woods Hole just got won the Audacious Prize, which I think actually Ideas Fest and TED are both part of. And her mission is to survey the twilight zone of the ocean between 1,000 and 3,000 meters below the surface. And it's a completely unknown abyss. That's the basis of our food chain. Mm-hmm. And that supplies food for a third of the world's people. And we know absolutely nothing about what species are there. The mass, they used to think that it was the bottom of the ocean. When they did the original sonar pings, they thought this was the bottom of the ocean, and what it was reflecting was what's likely the densest biomass on Earth.
Wow.
And they discovered it wasn't the bottom when they saw that it was moving up and down. But yeah, we collected a data set on microplastics that was unprecedented, but we didn't cover 0.0000001% of the ocean in that survey, and it was still the most robust data set that's in existence.
I was thinking of sort of kelp
Yeah.
We haven't studied it very much in my realm. I do know in the case of Enterococcus, to bring it back to this specific project, one thing we do know, again, from some sampling of aquatic environments, that Enterococcus actually don't tend to, we don't think that they live there. They end up there because of runoff from sewage and things like that, but we actually don't think they live there. So it's not a great place for us to search for Enterococci. They tend to be more land associated, but I totally agree with you. This is like a vast, you know, undersampled, understudied part of our world, and I'm sure there's a lot we can learn.
Great, thank you.
Is there a model like there is for CO2 atmospheric greenhouse gases in ice core samples? Is there a comparable model that you're using to look for shifts in the biosphere in the last century? Do you have a way to go back in time that's reliable?
So I must admit, I'm not, I don't know that much about the models around CO2, but your question about going back in time, I think, is one that I really, it resonates for me, because we spend a lot of time trying to take the kinds of data we generate to kind of rewind the clock to try to understand where these organisms have been and where they've gone, and try to ask questions of why. Because if you can sort of stamp a time on an event, say when two things split to become two different, or one thing splits to become two different things, you can start to understand maybe why that happened. And so we do think a lot about how to measure time and understand its relationship amongst these organisms we think about. I don't know if that's exactly relatable.
Your observation about Enterococcus not being native to the ocean.
Yeah.
Immediately made me think that that's very likely to change in the very near future. So how do we get baselines today as well as backwards in time? You know, what's already disrupted the baseline before we start making comparisons.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I think that's a really cool idea, and I think that could be definitely an offshoot. In fact, I would say that, again, this is very preliminary data, but I wonder if we're not seeing some things going back to the water in our new collection that Greg and his partners have helped to. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, so I think you're right on, and connecting that back to atmosphere, you know, planetary events, right? I mean, we love this stuff.
We'll commit to getting some blue whale scatter, some humpback whale scatter.
Yes, yes. I think that would be.
I don't know how that collection process would happen, but I'd be very curious to learn it.
Greg will figure it out.
Yeah.
The humpback's maybe easier than blue whale.
Just in terms of big ideas, what some, you know, one of the things that we banter around now are disruptive ideas or disruptive technologies or disruptive opportunities. And one of the things that I think we haven't really touched on is citizen science as a disruptive opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when I got involved in this, I saw the opportunity. So Ashley, as a genomics person, as a lot of people have heard over the last few days, the cost of genomics has gone down and the throughput has gone up through the roof. So now someone like Ashley can turn out 10,000 genomes within a 5 year. I mean,
easy,
if that was the only thing she was doing, it'd be within 1 year, but in this kind of collaboration, a 5 year project. And a guy like Greg, with his network of citizen science volunteers, can collect 10,000 samples. And, you know, how else could you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And the opportunity to put those things together, I think, leads to the kind of advances that we really need to solve a problem like antibiotic resistance or microplastics or wood smuggling or, you know, all of the different issues that Greg's addressing.
Yeah.
Just, you know, to put the antibiotic resistance issue into context, right now in the U.S., about the same number of people die from infections that can't be treated as die from gunshot wounds and also dying auto accidents. So it's about that scale. It's about 23,000, which is about how many people die in auto accidents and how many people each year get killed in the U.S. Those are infections we used to be able to treat but can't now.
Right.
Most of those happen in the hospitals in people who have gone in for a knee replacement or cancer or something else. And during the course of that stay, they picked up these bacteria that are hanging around the hospital that Ashley was talking about.
Yeah. So just if I could add on to the idea of this disruptive, citizen science as a disruptive idea, I think that what's exciting to me is the idea of like shifting the framing and shifting how people view each other, right? Mm. Like I think that there's so many people in the general public who have such a disdain for science. Like they don't believe science exists. And then this could potentially be a way for people to realize that actually science is really cool. Like science is the basis of life. Mm. And meanwhile, you have so many scientists who probably like look down on ordinary citizens for whatever reasons, and this is a way to bridge that as well. And I love thinking about the disruption in terms of those shifting of frames. I don't know if that resonates with either of you.
Totally.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely does. I mean, I've seen, back to Mike here, like we had one of the world's best mountaineers on a stage with Mike Gilmore at the National Academy of Sciences and their Science and Entertainment Exchange, and to watch like this incredible mountaineer talk to a scientist, both at the top of their field, but absolutely no crossover into that. Mm-hmm. And now they like know each other and know about their work, and they both are advocates for both of their work. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I mean, kind of along, I live in Kenya, and there's a lot of national parks there, and you know, the fee for citizens is much lower than it is for foreigners, of course. And part of the reason for that is also that, you know, Kenyan citizens, why should they care about preserving these places of these parts of the country if they can't get access to them and they can't experience them for themselves? Yeah. And I think like being able to bring people into these spaces is great service to the world.
One of the things, the last point I'd make in a follow-up to when I first met Greg in Bozeman, Montana about 4 years ago, we were talking over a beer about this, and it was a complete eye-opener to me. He was telling me about all these volunteers and all this, and so I said, Greg, that means we can get like 10,000 samples free, they're volunteers. And so one of the things that's worth thinking about is there isn't an economics that's developed around citizen science yet. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I need to know more about is what do we have to do to pay for this, or what kind of costs are there to, is a volunteer free, or how does that happen?
No, they're not. So our organization is currently 14 people. That includes communications, operations. We have a permitting specialist that works with us. It takes a lot of money to organize these, but we find that we're generally, we can do about 6 times the work for every dollar that we spend on a project. That goes up, and that gap increases as the scale of the project increases as well. And the reason for that is we're building trainings, we're bringing in new technology to do that. Permitting takes a long time. We're spending a lot of time developing the concept with our partners. And so we generally operate we have a partial fee for service model and a partial philanthropic model. And we're finding that a lot of our partners don't have the resources to just hire us to go and do this. So we're co-fundraising with them and looking to private individuals and to foundations to really get a lot of this off the ground. And that's going to be key to really solving some of these issues.
Well, mine's question is a little bit of a sidebar, but with all the bugs, birds, and poop that you guys are bringing into the country, how much issue are you having with the USDA in their quarantine stuff, inspections, and seeing what all's coming in, and if there's some special stuff that y'all have to do for it?
Yeah, so APHIS is who really controls most of that stuff, they've actually been great. It takes going through a permitting process. It takes making sure that they understand the precautions we're supposed to take and making sure that they feel comfortable that we're transferring that information to our volunteers and that shows up in the actual poop that's coming across the border. APHIS has been great for the U.S. The export from 110 countries, for example, can be much more challenging. And so generally things that are biotic in nature, so plant life, insects, animals, that creates a lot more challenge than something that is thought of as abiotic, even though we know it's not, like a scat sample. So scats were actually easy. Water was easy. It's when we're working on things like leaves. We have a project that we're creating a genetic reference library for commercially viable timber species, trying to make it possible to one day be able to zap a piece of wood at a port and instantly know what species it is, where it came from, and whether it was legally or illegally harvested. Well, to import those hardwoods from Madagascar and from Africa, from Russia, all over the world where we're collecting or will be, that's going to be a massive permitting lift. We're going to spend a lot of money on that.
Well, thank you both so much. We're just about out of time. I just wanted to close by quickly asking you, in 5-7 years' time, what do you hope is the overall environment for citizen science?
Greg.
I hope that the field shifts away from being so focused on education towards it being about outcomes, which then circles back and has lasting education and lasting engagement. So I want to see that every one of the world's issues that we're facing, whether it's human health or environment or whatever it is, somehow engages the masses where there is a data limitation. This isn't a tool that's going to work for every problem. But every problem that can be solved or is data limited, I want to make sure is and is effectively solved and addressed using the armies of people who are willing and motivated to help.
Wonderful. So I think that's beautiful. And I would, I totally agree. That would be a wonderful vision to see come to life. And I would just maybe add that I'd like to see this, a cultural shift in that, and I think I'd like to see this being introduced early in education, have it tethered. But I agree, it needs to be married with outcomes.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, yeah. Thank you all for joining us, and please join me in thanking our panelists.